Okay, well, I'd like to thank the organizers for the invitation. So I'll be telling you about some simulations of protein aggregation. And we already had a very nice introduction by Scott Shell on this topic. So I'll be very brief and simply tell you that proteins are important entities in our body. They play a host of roles, from structural to enzymatic. And in order to function, they need to adopt a certain shape. But not all proteins fold properly. And this could be due to a simple point mutation or to something in the cell environment, a pH change, a temperature change, that somehow destabilizes this protein and doesn't allow it to fold. And this is a serious problem for the cell. The cell relies critically on a certain concentration of active proteins to function. But a second problem is that these incorrectly folded units tend to self-assemble, polymerize, and form very large aggregates. And the aggregates that you get come in a variety of species, but the most common one is something known as a fibril. So I think most of you have heard of these in the context of diseases. If you look in the brain of a patient with Alzheimer's disease, you'll invariably find these amyloid plaques that are made of fibrils or extended aggregates of a given peptide. But this is not limited to Alzheimer's disease. There are a host of diseases, Parkinson's, mad cow disease, etc., that all seem to have this common thread of incorrect folding and subsequent assembly. So the proteins here are very dissimilar. They don't have any structural similarity in the monomer state. They don't have much sequence similarity. But the end product is actually strikingly similar. So this end product looks something like this. It's an extended fibril, and it has structural features that are consistent for all systems that have been studied. Basically, the surface has hydrophobic grooves that can bind to a variety of small molecules that specifically stain these amyloid fibrils. And if we zoom in, we see a very specific pattern of beta sheet. So beta sheet is a type of secondary structure, and you see these arrangements that are known as cross beta diagrams. So what kinds of proteins aggregate? So a big class of aggregating proteins, and that's what I want to focus on primarily, are intrinsically disordered proteins. So these are proteins that I mean, not as famous as regular proteins in the sense that they don't really have a three-dimensional structure that they fold to. They tend to populate a range of interconverting structures, and they usually only adopt a given structure upon binding to another complex. That's one category. Regular globular proteins, this is a protein that aggregates. In the case of Lou Gehrig's disease, it somehow unfolds and assembles. But I think perhaps more interesting is the fact that you can take a protein that is essentially harmless. This is SH3. It's a model system for protein folders because it behaves so beautifully. But if you take this protein, destabilize it, and crowd it, or concentrate the solution, you will get amyloid fibrils that look just like the Alzheimer fibrils. So this is important because it says that the ability to aggregate is encoded in this polypeptide chain. It's not just an anomaly of certain disease sequences. So really, we should think of aggregation as an alternate to protein folding in a concentrated or crowded environment like the one in the cell. And then I just want to mention that the body actually uses this ability to aggregate for function. So in bacteria and in various organisms, the body aggregates these proteins to create structural scaffolds. All right, so here's a cartoon of aggregation. We start with a protein monomer. It could be one of these folded proteins or one of these natively disordered proteins. Presumably, you're adopting some conformation that's not happy. From this step on, you start aggregating. You populate a range of oligomeric structures. And you know, everything's a cartoon in part because we really don't know much about what's happening. These partially structured entities or these early oligomers are transient species, so you don't really capture them in experiment at atomic resolution. The oligomer structures that we know of are mainly captured by AFM or EM studies. So again, you see these blobs that have annular type shape or an amorphous type shape, but we don't have much atomic resolution. I should say that there is some similarities in the structures populated by different peptides that aggregate. There is an antibody that recognizes some of these oligomers. So there's some structural similarities that emerge, and eventually you form these fibrils. Now, fibrils we have a better grasp on because there's some very nice solid state NMR work on these systems. So what we'd like to do is try to simulate this process and understand the aggregation. And we've heard a lot in the last few days about time scales and length scale issues, and this is a particular problem here. So folding, fastest proteins, microseconds, aggregations can go on for decades. In Alzheimer's disease, you start getting plaques in the brains in your 50s. It starts progressing, for decades onwards until you're 18 and you start really getting these symptoms. But these are processes that take a while to fully evolve. So we also heard a lot about various coarse graining schemes and fully atomic schemes. I'm going to talk about the two extremes. The first I'll talk about are fully atomistic simulations of aggregation, and I'd like to use that as a motivation for why we do need to develop coarse grained models, which will be the second part of my talk. And we also heard, no need to go over this, all kinds of sampling techniques that we need, and replica exchange is the one that we use. So I'm going to talk about two topics. The atomistic simulations are going to focus on Alzheimer's disease. And I should say that most of what I do in Alzheimer's disease is with experimental groups, and we're very interested in things like what happens if I make a little point mutation here, and this little side chain moves, and et cetera, et cetera. And I think that's really interesting if you're in that field. I guess it's interesting if you have that point mutation, if you have the gene that encodes for it, and then you get early onset Alzheimer's, but presumably no one here has that. And you're all healthy, so I don't think it's particularly relevant for me to talk about details. What I'd like to do instead is not focus on what makes all of these sequences that we study different in terms of aggregation, but what makes them similar. Are there things that we see in these atomistic simulations that really translate from system to system? And can we use that maybe as a rationale why we may not need to look at things in atomistic detail and we may be able to coarse grain? So Alzheimer's disease, as we all know, is a form of dementia. It's the most common form of dementia worldwide. And here's a healthy brain, and here's an Alzheimer's brain. And what you see in Alzheimer's is death of cells. So you're losing brain matter in the language and memory areas. So once you're at this stage, it's really over. So you'd want to catch the disease at an earlier stage. So if you zoom into the brain, this is a healthy brain. These are the brain cells and neurons in purple. In Alzheimer's brain, you see two things. You see aggregation of a tau protein inside the neurons and aggregation of a second protein called the Alzheimer A beta peptide in the extracellular space. And I'm going to focus on this. So you have a large protein called APP. And in normal metabolism, it gets cut by various enzymes. And what you generate is a peptide called Alzheimer amyloid beta peptide. And this is happening to you right now, but it's not a problem. Your body is clearing it. We don't really know the function of this peptide. We know that in boxers who get repeatedly punched in the head, they have overexpression of this and Alzheimer's, and presumably has something to do with blood clotting. But this peptide is interesting because it has various parts to it, but you can chop it up. You can take various fragments of it, from a mini core that's just four amino acids long to larger fragments, and all of these aggregate. So let me just show you simulation results on these peptides, just focusing on what's similar, not what's dissimilar. So for the smallest peptides that you have, if we do this replica exchange scheme and look at the monomeric structure, we just see various collapse states, but we also start to see extended conformations that have the beta strand that's found inside of the fibrils. If we go to larger systems, so these are longer A-beta constructs, We actually see something that emerges, which is the presence of beta hairpins. So again, most of the structures in our simulations are disordered. This is a small population that seems to emerge. These are simulations done with different force fields, different solvent models. It doesn't seem to matter. This seems to be a rather robust structure. But fine, these are all A-beta peptides. They're pretty much all the same thing. Let's go to something else. Let's go to a prion peptide. We also see a hairpin. The IAPP peptide seen in type 2 diabetes, also a hairpin. What's more telling is that if we take the same peptide and we make six-point mutations, that gives you the rat form of IAPP. This form cannot aggregate. We do not see any hairpins in this mutant. And in fact, we find a structure that's very reminiscent of the NMR structure found for this species. So the question is, we see all these hairpins. Are they direct precursors for aggregation? And at first glance, you could say yes, because here's the monomer from our simulation. Here's the actual fireball from solid-state NMR. The strands that we get actually match up with the strands from the fibril with the loop at pretty much the right location. But actually, you would be mistaken, because there's a fundamental difference between a hairpin and what you have in a fibril. So to the untrained eye, they look the same. But the difference is that the hairpin has hydrogen bonds between these two strands. In the beta arch or strand loop strand geometry seen in fibrils, the hydrogen bonds are between these sheets. And in this loop region here, you actually have side chain packing. So there are two forms of geometries for fibril, the strand loop strand or just extended strands. So we want to look at a model system and see, what can we do with this hairpin, and how can we end up with an extended strand? Is this hairpin really necessary for the aggregation process? So we're looking at A-beta 2535, which is a natural product in your brain that does aggregate. So this is a fibril model that we constructed. So if we look at the monomer, we see these hairpin structures along with collapsed entities. If we look at, this is data from these free energy replica exchange simulations, where we plot free energy as a function of order parameters that tell us something about structural dissimilarity. If we look at just one strand in the context of a monomer, dimer, trimer, tetramer, we see that as our aggregates start increasing in size, we start getting extended features. If we look at the actual aggregates, for a dimer, I'm going to pick out a few structures. This is two hairpins coming together. This is a hairpin and an extended strand. Trimer, we start seeing the emergence of extended structures. And we also see extended structures with a hairpin. And this goes on. And the point I want to make is these extended structures may look like the correct thing to start your fibril. The problem is that these structures are not stable, and they tend to buckle. The only way that you can get a flat sheet, which is what you want for your fibril, is actually to have these hairpins stabilize your growing sheet. So we can come up with some sort of kinetic-ish model for what's going on, where we'd start with a monomer. In a second step, you'd have an association of two hairpins. One of the hairpins would then get partially destabilized, and we could then add a second hairpin to the growing front, and you could continue this way all the way to fibrils. Now, an important component in this model is that the hairpin has two roles. One, it stabilizes the sheet, but also it allows addition at the growing front. And a requirement for this hairpin is that it's not too stable. The hairpin has to be able to open up and rearrange its structure. And we think this can explain some experiments. So there was a recent experiment in the hard group. And what they were trying to do was actually to show that this hairpin was critical for aggregation. So their reasoning was, let's take this A-beta peptide, and let's chemically cross-link it to force it to adopt a hairpin. And their hypothesis was that they would get very rapid fibril formation. But actually, when they did this cross-linking, they did not get any fibrils. In fact, they got some off-pathway aggregates. And I think our proposed model is consistent with that in the sense that if you lock a hairpin in, it won't have the ability to structurally rearrange. And I'll show you at the end of my talk some coarse grain models where we're explicitly trying to target that. So let me move on to the coarse graining and maybe motivate what type of coarse graining we're doing based in part on the problems we had with the fully atomic simulations. So as you can see, we did these very detailed simulations, but we pretty much stopped at a tetramer, partly because these explicit solvent atomistic details run for month and month, and at some point, you know, do we really want to keep just adding things on? And it's not the most productive thing to do. I think a basis for coarse graining is to look at the aggregation picture and see similarities. So we have all these different sequences, structurally different, but they all aggregate to pretty much the end product. They aggregate through intermediate species that are structurally similar enough that they can bind to common antibodies. And the kinetics of this aggregation process have been monitored, and they seem to follow a nucleation growth type mechanism. So there's some very generic features that we should hope to capture with simplified models. And we heard a lot about coarse graining from atomistic data, force matching, inverse Monte Carlo, iterative Boltzmann, et cetera. That's not what I'm doing. I'm doing, I don't know if I should call it crude coarse graining, but it's something of that spirit. And these are the types of models that are around in the literature that use this more toy-like approach, where we're just trying to see how far we can go with simple models. And I'd say the simplest is one that was developed by Muthu Kumar, and it's simply a cube with attractive faces. And I think before we become too snobbish and start poo-pooing this model because it's not getting any G of R's, right? I will say that you would be shocked at how much this simple model can actually reproduce. It just depends what questions you want to ask. So that's the crude model. The more sophisticated models are similar in spirit to what Marcus talked about this morning with a detailed backbone and side chain. The model I'm going to talk about is this one here. It's an intermediate level of resolution. And there are certain features that we wanted to keep. We wanted to be tractable, but we wanted to keep side chains because side chains are critical for fibril packing. We wanted to keep a description of hydrogen bonding because you need them to form the sheets. And we also have a twist in our model that's trying to mimic the chirality of the carbon atom that obviously we don't have here, but that propagates through the fibril. So, simple geometry and force field. We have three beads, two for the backbone and one for a side chain. We have a variety of patterns. This is a simple one that we study that has a hydrophilic face and a hydrophobic face. We have bonded and non-bonded terms. And again, you know, when you're making up these models, you don't want to go completely crazy in terms of parameterization. So you do put some thought into it. So for instance, for some structural properties, we would get them by surveying the protein data bank and looking at average bond length, angles, et cetera. For the non-bonded terms, there are a number of approaches. Probably the most straightforward is, again, go to the PDB, look at the frequency of amino acid contacts that are present. And for the hydrophobic-hydrophobic interactions, which are really key, we want to make sure that we tune our energetics so that they're at least somewhat consistent with data from free energy transfers of hydrophobic residues from nonpolar solvent to water. All right, so hydrogen bond. So as Marcus said, hydrogen bond is a problem. And there are many ways of doing it. We use a cheap approach that really biases towards beta sheets. And the reason we did that is because we specifically wanted to look at the assembly of small rod-like structures into fibrils. We are now rectifying this hydrogen bonding to include directionality so that we can really capture helices and more realistic transitions. So because I'm slow, let me move on. The point of these models, again, is we're not reproducing the A-beta peptide. We're looking at generic class of polypeptides and seeing when do they assemble. So what we will do is we're going to scan parameter space. So for instance, we're going to look at the strength of the hydrophobic interactions. What happens when you have very strong hydrophobic interactions? We're going to look at the flexibility of a peptide. What happens when you have a rigid peptide or a flexible peptide? And how does that affect aggregation? So movie time. All right, let's see how much better we can do than a fully atomic simulation. So remember, fully atomic simulation, I was doing no kinetics, just sampling. But here you can actually do a constant temperature Langevin dynamics trajectory starting from 400 independent peptides and actually get them to assemble into aggregates. So here are some snapshots of some final structures, and we get, you know, some realistic structures with sheets, double sheets, and multiple sheets. Now, in this particular case, we looked at a very rigid system. And what that does is it basically forces you into a fibril conformation. And this is not terribly realistic because we know that there are all kinds of oligomers that can be populated. So what we did is we looked at the backbone flexibility as a measure of beta sheet propensity. So amino acids that have high beta sheet propensity will favor a strand conformation. Amino acids that have a low beta sheet or beta strand propensity will be floppy. So by tuning this parameter, which is simply the dihedral term here, we can get floppy peptides and rigid peptides and scan parameter space there. So when you do that, you can see that you get a range of structures. You can get amorphous oligomers, beta barrel type structures, all the way to fibrils. All right, so what can we do with this? Well, what we can do is we can look at limiting cases and try to answer some questions as to how proteins aggregate. So here is a pathway when you have a very stiff peptide, a peptide with high beta sheet propensity. What we find is that it favors small ordered oligomers, and these assemble into higher order fibrils. If, on the other hand, we have a very floppy system, you get a very different mechanism that puts you still back to the same end geometry. And this mechanism involves a collection of oligomers that are completely disordered. And from within this disordered structure, you have emergence of beta sheet structure. So then we'd want to say, how does this correspond to reality? So I'd say the completely stiff peptide is an upper limit, probably not something you'd see. Probably in reality, you're somewhere in between here, or in some cases, even in the floppy regime. All right, so in the last few minutes, I want to tell you a little bit about seeding. So how do these fibrils grow once they're there? So a seeding experiment is when you chop a piece of your fibril and you throw free peptides in solution and you see how it grows. So here I have a fibrillar seed and I have rigid peptides. So when you do your simulation, what happens is you end up with fibrils. So this templates the growth of larger fibrils. But the thing to notice is that your seed is essentially retained and you're simply templating structures at the extremities. And you can see that here, where you're just growing structures. If, on the other hand, I take the same fibril seed, but I put floppy peptides, can the seed actually recruit them from solution and create a fibril? On their own, these floppy peptides would rather make just big fat blobs. And what we find is that, indeed, you can template the growth of these fibrils, but the initial seed is significantly disrupted. So even though we get what look like similar fibrils, they're actually structurally quite different. And what happens here is that these disordered oligomers make a blob that ends up disturbing the end of the fibril, inserting in, and now you have, again, this mechanism where you have disorder to order change with the beta sheet emerging. The seed was rigid in that case. We have other things with floppy ones too, but that was a rigid one. All right, so let me conclude with some surface studies. So in the brain, I'll do it in 5 minutes. In the brain, do you aggregate in a bulk? Probably not. You're probably aggregating on a surface. And this surface could be a surface made by a membrane. It could be a surface made by other proteins. But in all likelihood, you're not, you know, it's such a crowded environment, you're not just floating around aggregating. So we want to look at how surfaces could affect the aggregation process. And as a first attempt of a surface, we just took a surface made of hydrophobic beads, and we made them attractive to the blue beads here. So I'll just show you one result. So this is a Hamiltonian of a peptide that on its own in a repulsive surface or in the bulk makes blobs. That's all it can do. If we tune in an attraction to the blue beads, you find something quite dramatic, which is that this surface, a little bit like these fibril seeds, acts as a template and actually can create structure of ordered beta sheets. So this means that the surface does a lot of things. It's not only that it changes the kinetics of aggregation, it actually changes the morphology of the structures that you have. And if we compare the structures we get in a bulk to structures on the surface, we can find quite a few different structures on the surface. And I'm not going to go through all the structures. I'm going to just maybe highlight a few of them. So we did some in-depth characterization where we used a number of order parameters to look at the binding transition, and effectively we find that for greater surface attraction or stiffer peptides, you get, I think it makes sense, sharper transitions. And let me just focus on a few structures. So I'm going to just look at the formation of a single layer, because we see that in many cases. And we see many mechanisms by which this can happen. One of them, which happens when we have floppy peptides and not a terribly strong attraction to the surface, is a formation of amorphous aggregates that eventually deposit on the surface and form fibrils. I can show you a little movie of that while I take a drink of water. So you see these amorphous entities that eventually deposit, and when they deposit, they can structure. We have another mechanism which happens when we have stiffer peptides and moderate attraction to the surface, where you can form fibrils in the bulk, and then these fibrils can then deposit on the surface, and that's how you form your fibril. And then finally, we can have a mechanism that happens when you have very strong surface attraction, where you're essentially getting monomers or dimers, and they fall independently on the surface, can diffuse on the surface, and eventually form a fibril in this way. So to conclude, we can do the same seeding experiment that we did on the bulk on the surface, where we take a pre-structural single layer and watch the assembly. So here is a rigid, well, it doesn't matter if it's rigid or not, because it's just a seed on the surface, and we throw in rigid peptides. So when we do that, we get something that's not unexpected, which is the formation of fibrils, where you're really not disrupting your seed, you're just growing at the extremities. When you go to the floppy case, where now you have your fibril that's on the surface, and you throw in floppy peptides, you also end up with fibrils. But now you have a different mechanism where you have significant disruption of this initial seed. And what's happening is a little different from what happens in the bulk, because now we're on the surface. It's not that things are, you know, disrupting. What happens is that our fibril seeds can move, and you can have an insertion of a peptide. And it's almost like a wound opening and healing, and like that you can grow your fibrils longer. So I'm out of time, so I just want to say where we're going. Where we're going is we're trying to do something more sophisticated. In the sense that the peptides I showed you are, you know, maybe models of that KFFE peptide that really can't make hairpins. They can make, you know, a U-shaped or an extended shape. But we have models now that can make hairpins. So you can have extended structures to hairpins. And now we want to say, can we address this question of the role of hairpins in aggregation? The fully atomic simulations, you know, that's something we guessed. We made up a kinetic pathway based on some structures that we have. But this is a way now of testing these types of models. And as a first test, we took a beta hairpin and we forced it into that conformation. And indeed, we find that these kinds of structures don't form fireballs. They just make some kind of dead end constructs, which would be consistent with these experiments that were done on that A-beta peptide. And then another direction that we're doing is we've been looking at surfaces, but the surfaces we're looking at are really just model surfaces. And what one would like to do is to look at something more biologically relevant. So we've started, and this is not even presentable data, I probably shouldn't show it, but we're looking at aggregation on coarse-grained membranes. So these are a lot coarser than the ones that Marcus presented. They're models developed in the brown group. But I think this level of crudeness is probably appropriate given how simplified our models currently are. So let me just end by thanking students who did the work. The majority of the work was done by Luca Larini, Alex Marks, Andrew, and Chen Wu, with earlier work done by these students who have now graduated. And thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Can you comment a bit more about the role of the substrate corrugation for the assembly process?
The substrate what?
The substrate corrugation is your assembly study. Is it done on essentially flat surfaces, uniform,
yeah.
Or is there some crystallinity? Is the substrate rigid, I presume, at this
point?
Yeah,
that's a great question. So in this particular surface, it's made of hydrophobic beads that are stuck together. So it's essentially a flat surface. And it does affect how the aggregation happens. So for instance, we see aggregation often happens at a certain angle, and that's probably due to the placement of these. We haven't looked yet at defects in surfaces or surfaces that have a certain curvature, which would definitely affect the assembly.
Okay. I have two questions. One is about this growth of aggregates. In the beginning or in the middle of your talk, you showed something that I didn't understand, where one beta fault had to open in order for the aggregate to grow.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't understand how this is related to the latest simulation which you showed at the end.
Okay. For these hairpins, you need a peptide of a certain length so that you can actually make these hydrogen bonds. The system that we're looking at is more akin to this one has just four amino acids, so similar to our peptides. It actually can't form any hairpins. It just makes
it's too short to form a hairpin.
Exactly. It makes a strand or a loop because you need enough hydrogen bonds. My last slide was going where you were saying, we now have these longer models, but I didn't have nice enough results to show here, where you can actually now have a competition between something that's disordered or makes a hairpin. And we're now investigating whether this proposal made from atomistic simulation even makes sense.
And can you explain qualitatively why in the case of long molecule you need to open one of the hairpins in order to keep growing?
If you have hairpins that are in our coarse grain simulations, if you have hairpins that are just hairpins like that, you could keep adding them up and presumably try to make a flat layer. But eventually, these things will tend to buckle up, in the case of the layers, the sheets. Why they end up being stabilized is because you typically have a second layer that comes on top, and that allows you to keep the two flat layers. But if you just have a series of hairpins, they tend to buckle. Now, there are fibrils, I should say there are fibrils that are made from hairpins, but tricks are made. So for instance, there is a group at the NIH that puts a metal binding site so that you have a fibril layer of hairpins, a metal binding site, and then another layer. So you have to somehow chemically try to trick it. But on its own, it seems to be happier to just buckle up. It's just more stable.
Okay, thank you. And my other question is about other protein aggregations unrelated to beta structures. Are there diseases or other biological significance of, let's say, misfolded proteins which aggregate, or other cases of aggregations unrelated to beta structure?
Yeah, in fact, the beta structure in terms of disease may not even be that important. So the beta structure is something you see. So if you take an Alzheimer's brain and chop it up and look at it, you will find these fibrils. But whether they are terribly toxic is not known. So there are other misfolding diseases where it's actually known that these fibrils probably don't play a role. So in Huntington's disease, where you have this peptide that has a long polyglutamate stretch, that protein misfolds and maybe forms small aggregates. And what happens is single transduction proteins also have these polyglutamate stretches, and they bind to these small oligomers. So that would be a toxicity mechanism that has no fibrils. And there's another toxicity mechanism which, in fact, involves membranes. So the pores that Marcus was showing, there's a hypothesis that peptides may insert into the pores and lead to leaching of ion. So the fibril is an easy target because it's always there and seems to be an end product, but not necessarily the most relevant.
Thank you.
Other question? Go ahead. Greg?
So I have a question about the growth of these fibrils off the seeds. It seems curious to me that in one case the seed stays intact, in the other case it falls apart first before growing the fibril.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, how different are the kinetics of these two fibrillar growing processes?
You know, maybe because our seed is so small. So in our case, we have a very concentrated solution too. So once you have your seed and once the peptides come on, they're basically stuck to it. So then you have this rearrangement happening. We had expected the floppy ones that have to rearrange the peptide to be dramatically slower than the ones where you're just templating. But that's not necessarily the case, because when you have your fibril and the ones that have the rigid templating, these are now forming in the bulk, and then they have to come and bind to your aggregate, as opposed to the other ones where you just have these amorphous blobs that diffuse on. So the rates were not as different as we expected. It could be because our model is too simple. We didn't see really what we expected in terms of.
So it sounds like the kinetics are actually quite similar.
Quite similar, yeah.
So let me ask a follow-up question, if I may. So then in the case where they're disordered peptides, are they actually absorbing and then inserting into the seed, or is the seed coming apart and then...
No, so it looks like they're inserting, but they're not. They're actually coming. I can show you. I skipped over it a little bit. But they're actually coming and disordering and then restructuring. So let's see. I have some snapshots here. So it'd be something like this, where you'd have a blob coming on and then disordering and then restructuring. It's not that they're somehow managing to insert between layers or anything like that, or breaking up the entire thing. It's more a disordering at the end that propagates through.
For the seeding processes, does it matter what the individual amino acids and sequence are, or is it always kind of the same for floppy versus rigid?
So in this particular case, our amino acid sequence is the same. Okay. The floppiness is put in by tuning a torsion angle that makes it floppy or not. It's pretty much the same peptide, but one is floppier than the other. We'd see more dramatic differences if we had different sequences, or it probably might not work as well.
Other questions? Go ahead.
Okay. In terms of the equilibrium constant for adding an extra peptide, is it always the same? Do you know what that is?
No, we haven't looked at that in terms of a floppy versus a rigid.
Yeah, and just adding extra ones on. So I guess some simple tests from analogy with other things. So as long as your simulation is large enough and you don't deplete all your monomers and things, then I guess if it's isodesmic and you've got the same equilibrium constant, you have a sort of exponential cluster distribution. But for yours, it looks as though some of these are kind of growing.
Yeah. So, you know, also we have a small system, and we do deplete our monomers at the end. So
that's influenced a little bit by the process of doing the simulation.
Exactly. So we could do a better job where we'd keep throwing in peptides into our simulation box. But what we did is just a box with these peptides, and, you know, it ends when they're all together.
Okay. Yeah. So there's another very simple thing I guess you can do, because you can also calculate the free energy change for adding one of your systems or removing one of your systems from different lengths, which is quite an easy calculation to do just by, say, pulling or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you can sort of test to see if that's sort of...
No, it's a great suggestion. That is something we can do.
I have a medical question.
Okay.
Is it really established that these plaques are bad, or... Is it also possible that they might be the body's way to fight against something that hasn't been identified yet?
Yeah, so that's a good question. The question is, are these fibrils possibly actually helpful to the body? And the idea would be, if you have these small aggregates that are toxic, then your body might want to get rid of them. And it could get rid of them by inserting them into a fibril. And a fibril is a relatively chemically inert species. So it could be a reservoir of these unhealthy proteins, and to sequester them from solution. So, you know, prevent them from interacting with membranes or with other healthy proteins. But, you know, I think people don't know. But it is a nice idea.
Other questions? I have a question. You mentioned in the beginning there was a competition between protein folding and aggregation, and as increased concentration, you sort of drive this equilibrium towards aggregation. Have you actually looked at the concentration dependence of this transition between folding and aggregation, and what concentration? Because you looked like you were doing most of your simulations were done in dilute solutions. So in dilute solutions where far apart, did you look at concentration dependence of a process?
We haven't. In fact, actually, our things are actually pretty concentrated.
Right.
But that's something that we plan on doing with that new model, the one that actually can make a hairpin, because this model is so simple that, you know, it's just this. It doesn't really fold. It just, you know, opens and shuts. But the one that can actually make a hairpin, that would be a folded state, and then we could look at that competition. But we have not done any concentration dependence or any systematic study.
And on the just general principle of protein aggregation, is there an understanding, is there a critical nuclei you have to form before it begins to grow? And do you know what is actually the size and shape of that critical nuclei?
No.
Is there like a nucleation growth process?
So the kinetics do show a lag phase and then a growth.
Right.
So that would indicate that. But if you look at the literature there, proposals that's an ordered dimer all the way to a huge micelle, and people don't know.
Sure, but that's where simulations supposedly come in. But you haven't identified what would be the critical nuclei for your process.
So in this particular model, we are trying to do that precisely in these limiting cases, trying to see, you know, whether any of these species correspond, for instance, on the lower case, to some critical...
But you're putting some seeds up to predetermine size and shape.
These simulations were from scratch. So we had hundreds of peptides, in this case I think only 50, and coming together. And that we could answer it.
So do you see like in induction phase?
We see a lag and then a growth in the case of the floppy ones. In the case of the rigid ones, because they assemble so quickly, unless we kind of cheat and try to put it on a log plot, we don't see it. If we put the seeds and then throw the floppy ones in, you're going to lose the lag phase.
And do you have understanding of side to side versus sheet to sheet kinetics of growth? Because it looks like they mostly grow in parallel to the shear directions. Why don't they keep growing the sideways?
Okay, that's a good question. They actually do. They grow in two ways. They grow in by layer addition, and why you only see mostly monomer addition at the ends is, again, because in this particular model, we have a set number of peptides, and once you reach a certain, once you've depleted most of your monomers, they can only add on top. But in our larger system, where we had 400 peptides, what we saw is a small sheet forming, and our small sheet forming coming together, then growing by monomer addition, and then also growing by sheets coming together.
And in real life, do they grow both ways? Or do they
in real life, you know, it's that's part of the why we can get away with this. Little is known. So if you look in the experimental literature, they make hints of growth, lateral and longitudinal growth. But there's been the studies have focused mostly on if you have a fibril, how do you add monomers at the end? But the lateral growth happens too. And it's necessary.
Yeah. Any other? You can have a question? Any more questions? Okay, if not, let's thank all the speakers. And,